Former Cincinnati Police Chief Teresa Thigy spent months on administrative leave before City Manager Sheryl Long fired her. A day after that firing, reporters got the former chief's side of the story in an audio recording her lawyer released. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, what does that recording reveal? Then, records obtained by the Enquirer reveal a different story about a Gratis police chief and an officer who visited three Cincinnati public schools. And gas prices spiked twice this week. Is it more than the war in Iran? Joining me now to get the news review started are Cincinnati Business Courier, staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, and Cincinnati Enquirer, Cincinnati City Hall reporter Scott Wortman. Welcome back, Chris and Scott.
Thanks, Lucy.
Great to be here.
Great to have you both. Chris, I mentioned the day after City Manager Sheryl Long fired now former Cincinnati Police Chief Teresa Thigy, former Chief Thigy's lawyer spoke with reporters. First, is she going to fight this dismissal?
Yes, she plans to both appeal Long's firing of her. A little unclear on how that's going to go, but she also said she would, her lawyer said that she plans to sue in federal court over this.
Well, and Scott, her lawyer, Stephen M., also released this recording I referenced that really offered former Chief Thigy's side of the story. Where did that recording come from? What was it a recording of?
2 weeks before she was fired, the city manager gave the police chief a chance to give her side of the story in what they called a pre-disciplinary hearing. And basically for 2 hours, she laid out her case refuting what was said and what the independent investigation that the city contracted with an outside law firm to conduct. She basically went point by point refuting everything that was alleged in there and made pretty much far wide-ranging claims against city leaders and basically how she viewed their leadership and the demands that they placed upon her.
And we will get into some of those specifics. First, a city spokesperson told WVXU the recording was made with permission. It sounds like the recording starts after former Chief Thigy was already kind of in the middle of answering a question, at least the version that I heard. Chris, do we know why that is?
I don't know. No, I agree with you, though. It does sound like it started, the hearing started a little bit before the recording did.
Yeah. Scott, do you have any idea why it started kind of as the hearing was already underway?
I have not heard an explanation on that. No. I mean, I don't know if it was just that's when they hit play or if there was a reason that something was cut out. I don't know.
Okay. Well, let's get on to what former Chief Thigy could be heard saying on this recording. Scott, she accused the mayor of playing a role in her firing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, she said prior to the city leaders were under a lot of fire and heat from the public and during a contentious election on crime and perceptions of crime in the city. And the police chief said she had no indication that leaders were displeased with her leadership until the night when there was a double shooting on Fountain Square. And she called the city manager, who basically said there's a problem. Like she had previously, they had a conversation with the city manager saying, if there's ever a time you need me out of leadership, just give me a chance, you know, to resign. And then she said that the city manager said, now we have to have that conversation, and basically said the mayor, according to Chief Thigy, said the mayor told the city manager that either you fire the police chief or you get fired.
Well, and former Chief Thigy also said that Mayor Pureval didn't talk with judges about some concerns she had voiced to him. Explain what she said about that.
And that was one of many things she talked about as far as other issues that she brought up, as far as trying to, she basically in the meeting portrayed that she was trying to get more than just monetary aid for the police officer. She wanted to get more support from the city and help with certain issues. And one of those issues was having the mayor talk with judges. She said she gave the mayor a list of judges that she wanted him to basically address, what she said were repeat offenders being let out too early. And she claims that the mayor didn't see that as his job and made no effort to have such conversations. Now, the mayor said that's not true. The mayor says he has talked to judges and that they did improve a form that gives the judge more information when these cases come up on how to decide bail. So, and like a lot of things in this case, we're in the he said, she said portion of it. The sides are giving completely polar opposite, contradictory accounts of what was said and what happened.
Well, Scott, you mentioned how the mayor reacted to that issue that the former chief raised about the judges. But what about this idea that the chief expressed that the city manager told the former chief, hey, the mayor said it's either you or me? Have either the mayor or the city manager responded to that particular allegation in the recording?
Well, the mayor said that that's not true. The mayor said that this was the city manager's decision, and he has said throughout this whole 6-month saga that he has not put his thumb on the scale. But the chief says that's completely not true. This is all political, and she was made a scapegoat. So again, it's, you know, one side saying one thing, the other side saying the complete opposite.
Chris, the former chief also raised concerns about last summer's safety plan. Remind us about this safety plan, why it was such a big deal last summer, and then tell us what concerns she had about it.
Yeah, she basically accused or said that 3CDC, the Cincinnati Center City Development Corporation, came up with the safety plan, and that she was first informed of it when she had a meeting with Mayor Purval in his office. The safety plan basically called for increased visibility of police walking patrols through over the Rhine and downtown. I mean, that's kind of the surface level explanation of what it was.
And that was because of some of this high profile violent crime that had occurred last summer and right. Leading up to last summer, right?
Right. And, you know, there's kind of a, you know, generally, if you back up, there's a, you know, a division between police and maybe the public even about how effective that is. You know, in my career covering these types of things, the public always wants to see police on foot. It makes them feel safe, or whether it's a scooter or a Segway or a bike, you know, visibility makes the public feel safer. They will tell you that. And the police these days, you know, they question that. They, you know, if they have to get 6 blocks from, you know, from where they're standing and you know, address a call for service, they're going to get there a lot quicker if they're in their car. And so there's kind of a general, you know, there's a little bit of a difference of opinion there. So anyway, but that is not exactly why the chief had issues with it. She, you know, basically she was concerned about the manpower that was required and the amount of time that people, the police who, you know, were working these things were going to have to, you know, spend doing it. They were, you know, kind of at their wit's end dealing with these issues last summer. And she felt that that was not really an appropriate use of personnel at that point.
She also kind of accused 3CDC of being the driver of this safety plan, didn't she, Chris?
She did, yeah. Yeah, she said it was an absolutely unreasonable plan due to our staffing and other commitments. That was a quote from her. You know, 3CDC's response did not really deny that they came up with the plan. What they said in a statement was, we are aligned in our shared commitment to a vibrant and safe downtown and are grateful that the city is open to our input on matters relating to downtown public safety. Over the years, we have shared recommendations based on our level of presence and engagement throughout the Central Business District and over the Rhine. And they basically say, you know, we are intending that to be additive to, you know, help law enforcement. And so that's, you know, nobody said, no, we didn't come up with the plan. So that was of interest to me when we wrote that story.
Hmm. Well, Chris, was that summer safety plan one of the reasons the city manager gave for her decision to fire former Chief Thiege?
Yeah, I mean, basically the city manager said, you know, that she felt like the chief was not on board with that. And she basically said, Oops.
You're still with us.
little Bluetooth issue there. The city manager told her, you know, that you were told to follow the summer plan. And, you know, she claimed during the pre-disciplinary hearing that she was never explicitly told to do so. So there was, you know, that was an issue. That's kind of goes to the insubordination charge that Long, you know, brought as she was, you know, terminating Thigee.
Well, I know the city manager released a detailed letter addressing her reasons for firing the former police chief after she had a very brief press availability the day that the firing was announced. That letter, Chris, also said the former chief showed a lack of leadership by not coming up with ways to modify the plan. How did Thigee speak to that on the recording?
Well, she said that was not true, that she did try to modify the plan. There was an example that she gave. You know, basically the plan called for officers to walk up and down Vine Street and I think Walnut, one of the other overrun streets, and basically have two groups of them. And she said, you know, that's a lot to do all day. Sometimes there's 100-degree temperatures. It's a lot to do for 8 hours, monotonous. And so why don't we have two people do it in a loop? And she said that the city manager, you know, accepted that suggestion as one that was constructive. You know, most interestingly, the chief basically said that the city manager agreed with her concerns about the summer safety plan, but did not believe that she could stop it. And so, you know, there's a little bit of daylight there between the chief's explanation and the city manager's assertion in her firing letter.
Chris, have either the mayor or city manager addressed what former Chief Thigee said in that recording about 3CDC's role in the summer safety plan or the reasonableness of the summer safety plan, any of that?
They have not. They were willing to deny that the mayor told the city manager that it was, it was either Cheryl Long or Chief Thigee who was going to go, but they did not. They did not want to expand on any of Chief Thigee's points in the recording beyond what they had said in their own press conferences after her dismissal.
Well, Scott, former Chief Thigee also raised concerns in this recording about Iris Rowley, who's been working as a city consultant. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Iris Rowley, who the city has contracted with for the last 4 years, she's a local civil rights leader, has divided a lot of opinions among police officers and the public. But she basically, in the hearing, was listing a variety of ways that she sought emotional and like professional support from the city. And one of those, she brought up Iris Rowley. Her quote in the meeting was, as she's talking to the city manager and the city attorneys that were there, "Where are you with an advocate, an Iris Rowley, who thinks she can go around and do and say and interfere with officers and never be held accountable?" So I guess she basically felt, and this is what the FOP had said last summer when they called for the city to fire Iris Rowley at the end of her contract, she feels that the FOP had said that they felt that as an advocate and as someone who's monitoring the collaborative agreement, she follows police officers and is harassing them doing their job. So that appeared to be the concern that Chief Thigee was bringing up in the hearing.
Scott, have any city officials responded to those concerns, or has Iris Rowley responded?
Well, not to what the chief said in the hearing, but I did a profile on Iris a month ago or a few weeks ago. They've stood by Iris Rowley's work with the city. They say she's been very valuable asset to the city, both in historical knowledge and just being able to be like a liaison between the public and the police. So while they haven't addressed specifically like what Thigee said in the hearing, her support at City Hall seems to be pretty solid, at least as of now.
Mm-hmm. And you haven't heard from Iris Rowley directly about what the chief said in this?
No.
Okay.
She did not respond to this. So, okay. No, she hasn't come out publicly on what the chief said in the meeting.
Chris, what, if anything, can you hear City Manager Cheryl Long say in this recording?
I don't recall anything, but I could be wrong about that.
Yes.
The attorney, Chief Thiechi's attorney, said even after the hearing that the city manager didn't say anything during the meeting.
Okay. It sounds like that maybe wasn't the point of the whole thing. So that's interesting to know. Chris, what did former Chief Thiechi's lawyer say their next set steps would be in fighting all this?
Well, they plan to, as you know, there's an administrative situation where she can appeal her firing. And then they've also said that they're going to file a lawsuit in federal court over it, asserting, you know, various constitutional violations, including equal protection and due process.
Fair to assume you'll both be watching for any lawsuits that might be filed?
Check it every day.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer, Cincinnati City Hall reporter Scott Wortman, and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thank you both so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, records obtained by the Enquirer tell a different story about the recent Gratis police visit to three Cincinnati schools. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. I want to give you a heads up about something we're working on for next week. Are you a small business owner planning to use the tariff refund portal? Tell us your experience. Call 513-419-7100 and leave your name and comment. We might use your message on the air. Now, back to our weekly news review. Cincinnati Public Schools said police officers from a department near Dayton weren't looking for specific students when they showed up on behalf of ICE. But records obtained by the Enquirer tell a different story. Joining me now to discuss what she found in those records is Cincinnati Enquirer education reporter Grace Tucker. Welcome back, Grace.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. We've talked on this program about how this Dayton area police department visited three Cincinnati schools on behalf of ICE. Just remind us briefly what happened.
So we're still finding out details about what actually occurred, but the gist that the district understands is that the two police officers from Gratis, Ohio, outside of Dayton, visited the three CPS schools to do quote-unquote welfare checks. We found out later that they had a list of students that was provided by ICE. We don't know the exact student names on that list. The district says they don't know, which students were on the list. Their visit involved doing wellness checks, but they never had any face-to-face interaction with any students.
Well, and initially, my understanding was in the news conference, the school district said that they weren't aware that they were looking for specific students, right?
Yes.
But you got information this week that contradicted that. Walk us through that.
Yes. So a handful of emails that I got in a records request just kind of showed the timeline of events on that day. I believe it was a Wednesday, April 15th, that the superintendent, Shauna Murphy, spoke with the district's attorney and got a better understanding of what occurred. And she relayed to the school board members in an email on that day that the police carried a list of 30 students during their visits. She also shared that front office staff at Western Hills School verified two names on that list as students. Now, we don't know exactly what that interaction involved. We don't know. I don't believe that the police shared a copy of the list with the school. And disclosing that information, verifying those two students as being enrolled at Western Hills, doesn't technically violate any district or state policies around student privacy. But that was just a new tidbit that wasn't shared in a press conference that the district held the day after on April 16th.
Yeah. So how has the school district advised school staff to deal with ICE?
They have been distributing ICE-specific training material since January of last year. And I have a copy of the document, and it essentially outlines a step-by-step guide for what to do if ICE agents come on school grounds, beginning with having the agent state the nature of their visit. So I assume in that exchange is when the agent said that they were doing quote-unquote welfare checks in this instance. It also outlines that police need a subpoena or a warrant of some kind to actually seize a student or talk to a student, rather. And the Gratis police did not have any of those documents. And it also really emphasizes the importance in contacting the district's general counsel, Dan Hoying. He's awesome. He's very helpful. And they really want front office workers to direct all questions and all inquiries from any law enforcement, ICE or otherwise, through the district's general counsel so that the school day is not interrupted.
You mentioned that schools can disclose whether students are enrolled there, so that wasn't breaking any laws or rules or anything.
Yes.
Do you know whether the school district notified the guardians of any of the people on that list the Gratis police had, especially these two Western Hills High School students?
I do not know. The district did not answer my questions. They really just doubled down on the fact that they are very happy about the way front office workers responded. They're satisfied. I asked if they are going to adjust their training at all. Now that we do know that folks working on behalf of ICE won't even necessarily have ICE printed on their uniforms, which can be confusing, I'm sure, for front office workers. But the district said no, they're not. You know, they're happy with the training that they've done thus far. They don't plan on changing anything, and they're very satisfied with how they responded.
Okay. Did Cincinnati Public Schools respond in any other way to the information these emails revealed, these extra details that you learned from these records that hadn't been disclosed before?
No. They really just— Their exact statement was that they want to move on. It's over and done with, they said. They said it's the discretion of the Gratis Village Council to decide what's going to happen with this police department. I believe one officer has since resigned. The officer that was accompanying the chief on these visits to Cincinnati schools has since resigned. The chief is on leave. So there's a lot of movement happening in that police department, and that's something that my colleagues are looking into. You know, given that Gratis is one of many small rural police departments in the state that have agreements with ICE.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to move on to another Cincinnati Public Schools story that you reported this week. The school district has a growing population of students experiencing homelessness. Tell us about the new Safe Sleep Lot that just opened and what it's designed to help with.
Yeah, so I got to go to the opening ceremony yesterday. It was a great turnout. There were school board members, city officials, stakeholders, as well as CPS parents and one parent, a mother who was formerly homeless, who spoke about the lot and, you know, all the resources that CPS has given her. So essentially, it provides 12 parking spaces to CPS families living out of their vehicles. It is... It was built up in a lot that already existed. So it's a parking lot that's just adjacent to William Howard Taft Elementary School. And the lot features a trailer that has bathroom facilities and a kitchen and showers and materials for folks to do their laundry. It has an office for a security guard. There will be a security guard on duty during all hours. I believe the lot is going to operate from 9:30 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. And really, the district has been very forthcoming with saying they know that this is not a long-term solution. In many ways, it's disheartening that it's come to this, but they're happy to be able to provide some sort of short-term security for families who are sending their kids to school every day, not knowing where they're going to sleep the next night.
Yeah. And these are families, to be clear, that this facility has showers, it has a kitchen, but they'll be sleeping in their cars. That's the idea of this lot, to give them a safe place to park so the parents and kids can sleep in their cars, right?
Yes, correct. And they are given car kits that have been assembled through lots of donated items, actually. So they'll have flashlights. They'll have a windshield cover for privacy. They'll have linens, pillows, blankets. So they will be given a set of you know, supplies when they come to the lot.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned 12 spaces. Is the school district pretty confident that that's enough?
They are. They have, so this whole thing was orchestrated by Project Connect, which is CPS's social services hub. And I spoke with Project Connect's director, Rebecca Beach, and she is more than confident that it'll be enough. She said on an average night, they're seeing 3 to 4 families within the district living out of their vehicles. So they're hoping that this will be more than plenty to kind of meet the need that they're seeing.
Mm-hmm. I'll say just from a personal perspective, in my former life, working as a reporter at Channel 9, I interviewed a mom who had to sleep in her car for several nights with her 3 sons. And one of her sons told me how frightening it was to be just parked on a neighborhood street and not knowing who's going to be there. He said it was really hard to sleep because how scary it was, especially that first night. So I imagine having this security, and there's a big fence around the lot too, right?
Yes, there's a fence. The mother who spoke at the opening ceremony mentioned, spoke about that fear and also about even just basic necessities, not having clean clothes, not being able to wash your clothes really deterred kids from going to school because it's hard enough, right, to be a kid, or especially if you're in middle school and going through sort of the developmental years. And I can't imagine not having those basic needs met. So the district is hoping to alleviate some of those concerns.
Yeah. What will be the hours of operation? This is not going to be open all year, right?
Correct. It will be open through the summer. So it opened on April 30th. It will operate through, I believe, November or December, when temperatures really drop. But the district has told me that they actually already have an agreement with a local church that has asked to go unnamed, a local church in the region who will house all the families living in the lot during those cold winter months. So there will be, you know, a place for them to stay. But otherwise, yeah, it'll be operating year round, 24/7.
Yeah. And what you mentioned, the school district's Project Connect and Rebecca Beach, who works so closely with families experiencing homelessness. Will there be an effort to help connect these families with other resources while they're going through this? I mean, you mentioned nobody thinks it's ideal to have, you know, parents and kids having to sleep in their car. What's going to happen on that front?
Yes. So one obstacle to shelter placement that I wasn't aware of before reporting on this issue is that a lot of times families living in their vehicles have a hard time being verified by the city as being homeless. So therefore, it takes them longer to be placed in a shelter because, you know, prior to this lot opening, if CPS families were living out of their vehicles and they were moving around to different parking lots or maybe laundromats or different locations, the city was unable to locate them and to verify that they needed placement in a shelter, which is how the process functions. So with this lot, Rebecca Beach said she is working directly with local family shelters to ensure that the families in the lot are verified as being homeless within 24 hours. And then thereafter are able to enter a shelter. So there's a hope that even folks staying in the lot, they will not be there you know, for many nights. Hopefully it'll be a couple nights and then they will have a bed in a shelter.
Yeah. You mentioned this mom who spoke at this event who had been formerly homeless herself. Did she speak at all about whether it would be helpful to know you're not alone if you're in a lot with a few other families, you see a few other cars, your kids can see other kids going through what they're going through?
Yes, definitely. So she's a single mother, a mother of 5, and she spoke specifically on the plight of single moms and how scary it can be just to speak out and ask for help because there's so much shame attached. So she got emotional at yesterday's opening, just reflecting on where she was a year ago and how she was, because she spoke up and actually connected with Project Connect and with Rebecca, she was able to find stable housing. And I don't believe she's in that spot anymore. But she spoke about the need for transparency and the need for parents to come together if they are experiencing this.
Yeah. I know I've heard from
people that parents are sometimes afraid to tell people, I've got my kids sleeping in my car for fear that their kids will be taken away from them. Mm-hmm. So a lot of fear and stigma all wrapped up in this. Well, Grace, very quickly, I want to talk to you about another local school district, Little Miami. A teacher there filed a federal lawsuit over something he was asked to remove from his classroom. What was in his classroom? What was he asked to remove?
He was asked to remove a poster that had the slogan, "Hate has no home here," with several hands holding different types of flags. There is an American flag, an LGBTQ plus pride flag, a transgender pride flag. He had that displayed alongside a Bengals flag. He has several displays hung up in his classroom. He teaches social studies. And in a highly contested board vote, he was ordered to remove it, I believe, at the start of this year in February.
And why?
So the board took issue with the poster, specifically with the LGBTQ plus pride flags and the transgender pride flag, because of a set of district policies they have limiting content related to, quote, sexuality or gender. And a few of the members on the board argued that by displaying symbols related to LGBTQ+, it was prompting, quote, ideology that they didn't want imposed upon students. And it's a really tricky issue. It is reflective of a House bill that limits that sort of content. So districts across the region are having to adopt policies like this.
Well, I know this teacher is suing. He was trying to keep his identity anonymous. The judge said no. Now he's being named. What's next with this lawsuit?
Hopefully, you know, there's been a set of motions made. I spoke with the teacher's lawyer a couple days ago, and they're hoping for a decision sometime soon. The gist of the lawsuit is he's arguing his First Amendment rights were infringed upon, and that the district's move was unconstitutional. So we'll see. I mean, it's ironic because when the board made the vote, the single board member who voted against removing the poster, Wayne Seibert, said explicitly, you know, this is going to open a whole can of federal lawsuits and complaints against the district. And we're seeing that immediately. Mm-hmm. And it's not a cheap thing. You know, the districts are paying for these lawsuits. So I intend to do some reporting on what exactly Little Miami Schools has spent representing themselves in this lawsuit.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati education reporter, Cincinnati Enquirer education reporter. I almost made you the education reporter for all of Cincinnati, for everybody. Grace Tucker, thank you so much for your time today, Grace.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Up next, what is going on with gas prices? This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Gas prices spiked twice this past week. Is it more than the war in Iran? Joining me now to explain are WCPO9 consumer reporter, also known as Mr. Don't Waste Your Money, John Matarese. Thanks for being here, John.
Hi, Lucy, and thank you for having me. It was a pleasure working with you for about 10 years over at WCPO9, and great talking to you now on WVXU.
Great to have you. And we also have Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter David Ferrara. Welcome back, David.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, John, lay it on me. How bad are gas prices getting?
This has been an amazing week, Lucy, because I've been doing this consumer segment for 21 years now, over that, 22 years. And I've never seen this happen before, where gas prices jumped three times in a week, including twice in one day. Let me explain what happened this week. If you haven't seen a gas station or you ride the bus, you're probably lucky in that case. Gas prices have been going up now since February. They were at about $2.79 was the average back in January. It feels like ancient history. We then gradually went up and up and up during the Iran war over the past 2 months. Up to $3.99. And a week ago, we did a report. Oh my goodness, gas is $3.99, almost $4. So that was where things sat for the weekend. Beginning this week, gas went from $3.99 to $4.29 at almost every Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky station. And that was a big jump because it was over the $4 mark. That really starts to have an impact on people's psyche. Well, we covered that 429 gas. Can you believe it? What's going on? I'm talking that 2 days later, 2 days later on Wednesday, gas prices that morning jumped to 479 at most stations. And then by the afternoon, some of those stations went up from 479 to 499. I was stunned because I drive by the Speedway on Columbia Parkway by the Precinct restaurant. I drive by that multiple times a day. It went from 429 to 479 to 499 in one day. Oh, now the price is near you, Lucy. You seeing that?
I've been closing my eyes willfully. I need to fill up soon, and I'm really, really, really dreading it, John. I have to admit. So, John, what did you learn about the reason behind this latest jump in prices?
Yeah, we've been talking to AAA and to Gas Buddy, which analyzes and keeps tabs on where prices are. And they say it's a 1-2 punch right now that we're dealing with. The first, obviously, the price of crude oil because of the Iran war. What happened over the weekend was talks broke off. In fact, the U.S. was supposed to send a delegation to Pakistan to negotiate on Monday. They called off that delegation. Jared Kushner, J.D. Vance, people were supposed to head over. They did not. They canceled it because there was no progress being made. And in fact, the president said something about, I can talk on the phone. We don't need to send people there. So when those talks broke off, crude oil went up to about $118 a barrel. It hit $120 briefly beginning of this week. That's huge when you consider that crude oil was at $60 beginning of the year. It's doubled since then. So once that happened, we all knew what was coming next. That's when gas jumped to $4.29. And nationally, it jumped to about that too. But the second hit, and this is only in the Midwest, was at a major, major refinery outside of Chicago closed down. They had a short brief fire, but they had to shut the whole refinery down, take it offline. It's called the BP Whiting Refinery in Whiting, Indiana. It's up near Gary, Indiana. They shut that down. That refinery produces millions of barrels of oil every day, of gasoline, actually, from oil. And that gasoline then goes to Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, and Wisconsin. When that refinery shut down earlier this week and it was down for about 3 days, that instantly raised gas prices throughout our region, throughout the Cincinnati region. And they didn't see that spike in Tennessee or in Georgia. If you have friends in North Carolina, they didn't see that spike because they get their gasoline from the Gulf, mostly from Houston. We get ours from the Chicago area. That refinery went down. And so you had the combination of crude oil set prices up nationwide, but then the refinery shut down, added about another 30 cents to it. We got up to $4.99 at many stations yesterday. And I was just out driving around this morning. And even in Newport, Kentucky, it was $4.99. And I was surprised by that because typically Kentucky is about 10 cents cheaper than Cincinnati.
David, I know you've seen stations charging $4.99 a gallon too. Where are you seeing that?
That's right. So earlier this week, there was a BP in Springdale that had $4.99 a gallon. And again, looking at Gas Buddy today, I mean, most of the stations that I had seen on Gas Buddy yesterday were hovering around $4.29 a gallon. But now pretty much the entire Cincinnati area is hovering around $4.79, $4.99 a gallon. The average actually jumped up today, according to AAA, to 479, up from 445. So it's continuing to tick up day by day.
Well, John, I got to imagine it's super tough for people who have to drive around for their jobs, like landscapers. What are you hearing from them?
Yeah, in fact, I did talk to a landscaper 2 days ago, and he said, I can't afford to fill my truck, because he had a big truck that hauls the flatbed with the mowers on it. And he said, I'm just putting half a tank of gas in because he says it's going to cost me $150 to fill my truck that used to be just a few months ago about $70. And so you think about how that's hitting people like that. Someone like a landscaper, he's locked in his prices to mow people's lawns already. He can't say, hey, everybody pay more. And so it's really hurting people like that. People who do deliveries, people who deliver meals, people who run errands, anything like that. Now, if you're DoorDash or Uber, those companies are assisting their drivers a little bit because think about it. Otherwise, DoorDash drivers would just stop driving right now. So they're actually helping their drivers a little bit. The drivers say it's not that great, but at least they're getting a little bit of a bonus during this tough time. But anyone who relies on driving their own car for any type of job, they're really getting hurt hard right now.
So, John, are other people, even the, I know you talked to people beyond this landscaper, or just regular folks who are running errands or going to the grocery store or whatever, are they reluctant to fill the tank all the way up too?
Yes, we saw several people the past 2 days. We've gone all around. We're in Norwood, Northern Kentucky, and we talked to drivers filling up, and I was amazed. This is a throwback to 2022. Amazed at the number of people who said, I'm not filling my whole tank. I'm getting $20 of gas and I'm stopping. I mean, so it's like a third of a tank and they're stopping because they're hoping that in another week, the prices go down. And David, you might have some information on this. We think the prices should start going down after this weekend a little bit because that BP refinery is back online. That's going to increase the flow. So we should get a little bit of a break probably Monday or Tuesday. David, I don't know what you're seeing on that front.
Well, you know, it's a combination of local and international factors from the folks that we've been speaking with, because even though the U.S. is one of the world's top oil producing nations and doesn't import much from the Middle East, because that price of crude oil nationally is, or internationally, globally, is still raised because of the war in Iran and the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, it's still going to have those high crude oil prices that probably are going to have some lagging effects with the price of gas.
David, there's also the factor of this summer blend. Talk to us about how that plays into all this.
Yeah. So some folks might not know that from the wintertime to the summertime, the gas that goes into your car actually isn't the same. They call it a transition period right about now in March and April. But in the wintertime, they use a type of gas that's under EPA regulations. So it's easier for cars to start up in the cold and also reduces smog emissions. But then in the summertime, they change that type of gas again to accommodate for the smog emissions. But because of that summer blend, it's a little bit more expensive, which raises the price of gas every year. And then you combine that with the fact that there's already more demand for gas because of the better weather and longer days and more people driving. That demand goes up, gas prices goes up. So it's multiple factors that are driving the price of gas in addition to the war.
Once that summer blend isn't required anymore, David, can we expect some relief?
Should be some relief. You know, they say it's typically about as much as 15 cents to the gallon to the cost of these higher grade fuels for the summer blend. So you'll see a little bit of a downtick from that. And then also, again, as demand goes down towards the fall and the wintertime again later this year, that should help bring the price down if there haven't already been changes in the other factors as well with the war.
John, I know you follow these gas prices very closely, and you've been doing this for decades, as you mentioned. You just talked about 2022. So are these gas prices a record, or is it close to an all-time high you've seen in the past?
Yeah, it's close to a record. We reported back in 2022, and I looked back on our coverage at WCPO, and we reported on gas hitting 525 very briefly. I think it was for a day, but that was the record. And you might remember that year because that was the year that all of a sudden these stickers started popping up on gas pumps around Cincinnati and I think around the country with a picture of Joe Biden pointing to the price on the gas pump saying, hey, I did that. I don't get involved in politics at all, but it was kind of funny, the picture of Joe Biden with his finger. I did that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm kind of wondering whether that might start happening again.
Well, John, I know your story Wednesday on WCPO.com linked to a gas prices map. Is there a way for people to figure out where the best prices are in the region or where they might be able to get a bargain?
Yeah, the best way is to go to the Gas Buddy map. You go to gasbuddy.com or the Gas Buddy app on your phone. They have a map. Also on WCPO in our traffic section, we have that map embedded there on WCPO.com. So you look at that Gas Buddy map and it shows you current prices. It's pretty accurate. It might be an hour or two behind, but it's that day's prices. And you can see, oh my goodness, it's $4.99 near me. But over here, it's only $4.29. And I can tell you that yesterday morning, I was in Norwood and I found a station for $3.99. It was the UDF over Smith Road in Norwood. It's not that price anymore, but it was still $3.99. So if you look at Gas Buddy, you'll be able to find some lower prices.
Well, John, what's the calculus that drivers have to do? Like how far to drive to get a lower price when you're paying for gas? I mean, that seems like some tricky math.
It is tricky math, Lucy. I say, you know, 2 or 3 miles, maybe. You know, if you're in Mason and there's something a little further down Mason Montgomery Road, oh, down a mile down the road, I'm going to save 30 cents. You know, a mile down the road is worth it. Do not get in your car in Ohio and drive across the Brent Spence Bridge into Kentucky because you heard that there's a station in Kentucky that's cheaper. You're going to spend more than that on gas to get there. You're going to spend so much time. In that case, it's just not worth it.
Yeah. David, have you seen any place with particularly low prices as you've been looking around at this?
Well, you know, I might be the wrong person to ask because I tend to rely on using my fuel points to bring the price down, which has saved me a few times, but has been proven less reliable as I use them all up.
There you go. Yeah, I've been using mine pretty hard too. Well, John, I know you live by the words, don't waste your money. What's your parting advice for concerned drivers these days?
You know, I think, Lucy, that if your car is low, it's getting near empty, and you say, oh my goodness, $5 a gallon. You know what? This might be one time you just fill it up halfway. Because I'm thinking that by next Tuesday or Wednesday, hopefully, with oil down a little bit and with that BP refinery in Chicago now working again, I'm hoping we get a little bit of relief starting about Tuesday.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with WCPO9 consumer reporter, Mr. Don't Waste Your Money, John Matarese, and Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter, David Ferrara. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Great talking to you, Lucy.
And again, I want to remind you about something we're working on for next week. If you are a small business owner planning to use the tariff refund portal, we want to hear from you. Call 513-419-7100. Leave your name and comment on a message. We might use your message on the air. We really want to hear from businesses who are planning or trying to use that tariff refund portal. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. You'll want to tune in next week, too, because we have a gardening show coming up Tuesday, and we know how much you love those. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts, even YouTube. We're cool kids on YouTube now. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.